Hi, I'm Mike Russo, and I'll be your host here for the next half an hour. I'm new to radio, but not new to national issues. I have 40 years of work experience with the federal government and about a year of experience with the state of Pennsylvania and a year with the city of Philadelphia. And as you'll soon see, I'm neither Democrat nor Republican, though I tend to be more conservative than liberal. And I tend to approach issues from an independent vantage point. In fact, I've been a registered independent for over 40 years. I have a special guest coming on in a minute, who I think you will find fascinating. He is very rare indeed, a black conservative, and as usual, will attempt to discuss issues on their merits and not on partisan politics. Kevin Jackson is the author of The Big Black Lie, How I Learned the Truth About the Democratic Party. I asked him to be here today because he has strong views on politics and national issues. You might have seen him on O'Reilly, Hannity, I think MSNBC. So he's getting kind of famous, as a matter of fact. Lots of people have heard of him. I first learned of them and spoke with Kevin about a week ago after reading parts of his book, and he agreed to be on here. He's had unbelievable credentials. He has an engineering degree from, I think, Southern Methodist University. Well, Kevin, you tell me. Give us some of your background, would you please?
Yeah, well, I mean, from a college standpoint, I'm an electrical engineer with a computer science and also a math degree. And worked, ran my own sales organization for quite a few years and cut my teeth there. And then I went into management consulting. And most recently, before I sort of pseudo-retired, when I decided to become more active in politics, I was a management consultant for some of the world's largest companies. And since then, in the year that I sort of took a back seat on that and decided it was time to get more active in politics, I've essentially built a, well, my blog, and of course, and then we've got a radio show that's about to be on a Fox affiliate here in St. Louis, a TV pilot we're trying to get featured on Fox. And, you know, we've been on, as you mentioned, MSNBC, The Cavuto Show, O'Reilly, Glenn Beck, and a host of others. And I think it's because our message resonates, the message that racism and classism that is classically sold as being a Republican or a conservative issue, quite frankly, is more of an issue for the people on the left than it is by any means for people on the right.
Yeah. Now, there's one thing about you that you haven't said, and I haven't said yet, but I got to say this.
All right.
It takes a lot of courage to be black and be a conservative at the same time, a lot of courage, because I've seen other black politicians and people be interviewed, and they tell you what they have to endure.
I think it takes a lot of character. You know, it's funny, you know, people think of it as courage because if there's so many ironies about being a black conservative, you would think that the black conservatives are trying to destroy the black community when you understand that 95% of the black community does not like us. And so you ask yourself, well, why? What do black conservatives stand for? Well, we stand for raising our kids right. We want them to go to school and graduate. We don't want them to become pregnant. We want them to have a good spiritual base. We want them to be brought up in a whole family unit. We want them to understand that their accountability matrix includes working for a living, getting a good job, and finding happiness, not stepping on the necks of others, maybe even being entrepreneurial, certainly giving back to the community, and so on and so forth. What part of that would you say, you know, goes against the grain of blackness? And the short answer is, of course, nothing.
That's right.
And here I want to create black CEOs, more black CEOs, and black people call me an Oreo or, you know, a chicken head or whatever. And that's where you have to understand that there is a big conspiracy, a big black lie
that's
being
right.
told to blacks by the leaders who dominate the conversation.
Well, that's in fact, Kevin, I don't quite understand it. My junior high school was 50% black. My father's butcher shop, I worked at all the time, 99% black. South Philadelphia, it's pretty much a black city or half black city. Camp I worked at, 50% black. For the most part, from what I can see, many, many blacks are conservatives. I don't understand why the liberals. And if you look at the first 100 years after emancipation, blacks mostly voted Republican.
Right, and we were thriving as a culture during that period. And the sad thing is that there is no reason why, you know, any of this should occur, And if you start following the breadcrumbs of what it is, well, guess what? Blacks have been sold out. The Congressional Black Caucus, who was led up those steps by Nancy Pelosi recently, has been bought and sold. I mean, and they are being paid to keep other people thinking in this same mode. And I mean, that's it in a nutshell. And when you look at the fact that these people's lives have improved so dramatically over the past, you know, in some cases, you know, 15, 20-plus years of being in the CBC, these are people that have gone from lower middle income to being millionaires, in some cases multimillionaires. Yet their constituents who they serve are living worse those decade or two since the Congressional Black Caucus.
And, you know, I guess the turning point was around 1960 with John Kennedy and then 64 with Lyndon Johnson. But if you look at that Civil Rights Act of 1964, Republicans and Democrats who supported it, many more Republicans supported it. For example, voting against that act, voting against the Civil Rights Act of 19, there were 21 Democratic senators voting against, 6 Republican senators voting against. And if you look at the congressmen, here once again, there was like 3 times as many, 96 Democratic congressmen voted against it, 34 Republican congressmen voted against it. So even then, if you go back to the statistics and everything else, it looks like the Republican Party has been more. Now, I'm not a Republican, but I don't like seeing a con being placed on anybody. I like the truth to come out.
Well, the fact of the matter is that anybody who wants to take more than 2 hours to understand the history of the Democrat Party, in my book, in a very funny and, I believe, a clever way, showcases this hypocrisy and the lunacy of it all, you'll find out very quickly that the Democrats have done everything they could possibly do to thwart the black vote. And when they finally couldn't, they just decided, you know what, let's just take over all the good works that the Republicans did. And they did it. They succeeded. And they succeeded because people, a good example, Lyndon Baines Johnson signed the 1964 Voting Rights Act. Everett Dirksen is the author, the Republican author of that legislation. Johnson said when he signed that legislation privately, we'll have those blanks voting Democrats for the next 200 years. He had no interest in improving the lives of blacks. He just wanted to make sure he kept Democrats in power. That's the irony of all of this. And it would be laughable if it wasn't for the fact that a small group of black people, the Congressional Black Caucus, are running this country, but they're being led by the elites, the Democrat elites like the Pelosi's, and the Harry Reid's and the Barack Obama's and the Hillary Clinton's, and they're making America believe that that's the pulse of America, what these guys think, that we should all be victims. We've got Al Sharpton running down to Arizona to rescue illegal aliens, people in this country illegally, comparing it to what? Civil rights.
Right. You're into this Arizona immigration law. Have you looked at it? Have you heard some good analyses of it? Because it looks to me like here, once again, racial and ethnic stoking is being done. Because when you look at the law, the Arizona law mimics federal law, only slightly less, it's easier. What essentially does, from what I understand, and that is it makes it a state crime as well as a federal crime, and therefore authorizes state law enforcement officers to enforce immigration law. That's basically it. All the other stuff.
Arizona's laws are they're using state sovereignty, which is the way the Constitution was developed. The things that are not explicitly given to the Fed are for the states.
Right.
Period.
Right.
And they're exercising their rights, and they're saying, "Guess what? We're being overrun. They're killing our citizens."
They're only doing this because the federal government is not doing its job. It's not doing its job. They would rather not do it. It's expensive.
But let me say one step further. It's not that the federal government is not even doing its job. The federal government is saying, we don't think there's a job to do. They don't want to do the job. They're saying, you've done wrong, Arizona, for enforcing the laws of your land. You've done wrong. It should not be illegal for people to come into this country. Forget that we've got a legal system that's got people lined up trying to come on. To heck with that. Let's just go ahead and make it. Let's let these people come on board and forget the way that people have been doing it. And, oh, by the way, it doesn't matter that Mexico, if you did exactly what they're trying to do to our country, you'd be thrown in jail.
Absolutely. You got that right.
So that's the irony, is that, you know, liberals have – and by the way, all of that's for a vote. It isn't because – the Democrat Party is so enthralled with with the Mexican population that's flooding over here. They're not at all. They could care less. All it does is it ensures that the elites get to control things from the top, and these group of Mexicans become the next group of pawns.
Well, as a matter of fact, I guess new immigrants, illegal aliens, et cetera, about two-thirds vote for Democrats. So they want to get as many people in here as possible.
Absolutely.
Knowing that they'll win elections that more easier.
Absolutely. So, but the idea that, you know, you've got this demagoguery going on in the black community is pathetic, and that's why we recently started the Black Conservative Coalition, which is blackconservativecoalition.com, because we're doing what's called a Black Conservative Census, because we're going to count the number of blacks. We're forming this group as an alternative to the NAACP.
I see.
And we've set up affiliates so we could deal with the affiliates as well, you know, but... Mm-hmm. The long and the short of it is that we want to be the alternative to the NAACP when it comes to these issues. We don't want the sounding board for blacks to be something to do with all the thought that the NAACP is putting out. Because the fact of the matter is, black thought is a lot less monolithic than it appears to be.
Right.
You know, if you listen to the NAACP, you know, blacks want to be victims. They want to be on welfare. They want to get food stamps. They want to live in the projects. You know, and they want to complain about everything. Well, that's not true.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got to stop that narrative and get things back on track, because that's not the America that I grew up in. The America that I grew up in, little kids grow up playing together, no racial tension. You can go to a mall in Chicago or in some big city, you'll see 15, 20 nationalities walking around, not a bit of racial strife.
Right, right.
You know, the only time you hear about racial strife is when some bill needs to get passed, and then they start pitting either black against white or rich against poor.
Right, right.
And it's always coming from the left.
Yeah. I got another question for you, a little bit different than what we're on right now, which I think I can't wait to hear your answer, because maybe you can give some good advice to anybody out there, including myself. Now, I'm not white. I'm olive. I'm looking at my skin here. I'm green olive, I guess.
All right.
How would an olive person criticize the president's policies without being considered racist?
Well, let me ask you this, Olive Man Mike. Okay. Are you racist?
No.
Okay. Well, then you should criticize without worrying about what you're going to be called.
No, but I don't want anybody to think that. Let me tell you what I'm thinking. You can tell me if I'm off track or not.
Sure.
Got to make a clear distinction that you have nothing personal against President Barack Obama. You mean he seems like a friendly guy, he seems like a good family man, a good father, et cetera, et cetera. His policies, however, and he's smart, he's intelligent, but his policies are far, far to the left, which you disagree with. Nothing against the man, not denigrating him, I'm still calling him president. So what I'm saying is show respect, don't diss the man, and just show the policies I disagree with. I think they're bad
but
for
you
the
don't,
country.
But the, okay, so the question is, if everything you just described, and you say I have no disagreement with him, I just disagree with his policies, and you're called a racist.
Yeah.
I say to you, are you a racist?
No.
Because if I walked up to you and I asked you were you a pedophile, you'd probably be pretty offended. But to be when I ask you if you're a racist, you're like, well, no, I'm not
no,
a racist.
I'm offended.
You know. Yeah. In other words, if you're not what they're, I tell people this all the time. If you call me, if you shouted me the N word, I look around to see where that person is.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
I'm not that person.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So if you say, Kevin, you're a racist, I just chuckle. I go, well, great. Okay, you're entitled to your opinion, but I'm not going to defend my saying to somebody, I don't agree with his policies. You're a racist. Well, you can think what you want to think. I know I'm not a racist.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not even going to entertain the question. And by the way, if you do want to say things like, you know, if you want it to be confrontational, which I usually am, I say, well, then let me ask you this. You're a black person. You voted for Obama, right? Did you not vote for McCain? No. Okay, well, then you're equally as racist because you didn't vote for the white guy. No, man, it was a chance to make history. Well, I don't care. You're a racist because you voted for the black guy. You didn't vote for the white guy. So, because turnabout's fair play. I can only assume about you what you've assumed about me.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you something. This has been bothering me for many, many years, and I still don't quite understand it. And you may be much more involved and knowledgeable about this issue. You know, when welfare was first passed, it was deemed to be a very good thing. I mean, we were helping people who were poor, who needed help, which is a good thing. Then back in, I guess back in the 60s, a Democratic senator from Massachusetts, Daniel Patrick Monahan, he published a report. He did a study and he published a report from his senatorial committee showing that aspects of that welfare program were harmful to the black family. Specifically, right. there was something called the no man in the house rule. So like if a welfare person came for their weekly visit or whatever, and there was a guy around, the woman involved, she might be thrown off of welfare because if you got a guy here, he's supposed to be supporting you, not the government. So what it did, it helped break up the black family. So back in the 40s and stuff, black families were much more intact. There wasn't nearly the illegitimacy rate as there is today. And basically, you can put it at the doorstep of our welfare program. So what gets me is, okay, when that report came out, people didn't know when they first passed the welfare. Okay, they should have changed it, made it different, and made it okay. And they did not do that because they wanted to continue to get the black vote. And they didn't change anything. They just kept it the way it was. And I see this pure politics. And it harmed the black community, their constituency.
Well,
the short answer
is you've answered the question. Yeah. They knew from the studies that it was harmful to the black family. They also knew that if you have a whole black family, the likelihood of success is good. There were also studies back during that time about single family units. Everybody knew that if you're a single mother, because let's face it, the moms tended to raise the children, single mothers struggled in raising their children. Mm-hmm. They create miscreants, as Ann Coulter put out in her book, Guilty. And, you know, and that cycle is a vicious cycle because these kids occupy America's prisons. And they occupy them overwhelmingly based on economic levels. And in other words, the poor are the ones going to prison. And guess who occupies the poor? You know, who constitutes the poor in America is typically blacks and Hispanics and the minority cultures. So that's the reason that you don't have per capita more blacks in prison. You actually have actual more blacks in prison than non-blacks, or certainly than whites, not as a ratio, but in actual number. And that's pathetic. That's the only category that we lead. We don't lead in number of overwhelmingly the number of CEOs or the number of businesses that have been started or the number of college graduates. You know, we lead in all these negative economic indicators and negative societal indicators. That's a huge problem, and that's the reason why liberalism and these policies have to be stopped. I tell people all the time, if you find somewhere where socialism or communism works, tell me where it is, because I'll take you there, and I'll show you people living at the very top of that strata, enjoying life like, you know, living like rich fat cats, and then I'll show you the rest of the people who are nothing but poor. And I will guarantee you that the people of color will be the most persecuted, period.
Right, right. Let's move on. We have about 3 minutes left.
Sure.
The stimulus package, the huge deficit spending, from what I understand looking at the statistics and things, the people hurt the most were the people who are most in poverty, and that includes lots of African Americans, lots of Hispanic Americans. So they were hurt the most from this thing. And if you go back to the origin of this whole crisis, it looks like to me, if you go back to the very, very origin, a lot of people were involved. And they didn't maybe mean to do this, at least not at first. It started with Jimmy Carter with that Reinvestment Act, Recovery Act, and where it kind of loosened up the lending for people who wanted to own homes. It made it easier. And that was fine. For what he did, that was fine. It was not yet too far. But then I guess in 96, Bill Clinton amended that act, and it made it even much more easy to...
It's not that he made it easy. What he did is he allowed banks to now operate not only as banks but also as investment vehicles. And so they created the investment vehicles that are in discussion today. And essentially they started bringing together their good investments with a lot of bad investments, but selling it with the good portfolio, you know, kind of putting lipstick on the pig.
Yeah.
And it caught up.
Well, what undermined the whole thing, I thought, was the fact that the housing market went bust. I mean, I think that was, you know, because there were a lot of people that could not repay and not pay their mortgages and stuff. That was like the foundation, the origins of the whole problem.
Well, there was a lot of complicit things that happened. I mean, yeah. The wrong valuation of houses that just flat out weren't worth what they're being claimed to be worth, And, you know, so when that bubble finally burst, because it was going up and up and up and up and up, because people were fictitiously buying homes that they couldn't afford, and now you're back to the original breadcrumb of Jimmy Carter saying you will let people who have poor credit, who don't have make enough money, and so on and so forth, go get something that they really haven't quite figured out how to get yet. So instead of helping blacks become more self-sufficient and go out and earn, get better jobs and earn better livings and really afford those homes, and not only that, have the proper education to know that, you know, just getting into a house doesn't make it yours. He created a vehicle that just said, no, don't worry about it. You're lesser than everybody else, so we're going to give you this hand up, you know, this handout. And guess what? At the end of the day, the black neighborhoods are some of the worst neighborhoods in America. The houses are in terrible shape. They're not worth a fraction of what the value of what they were sold for. So these people ended up getting taken.
Yeah. Yeah. It looks like then as Senator Chris Dodd got involved and Congressman Barney Frank got involved by preventing in around 2005 the investigation and stricter regulations of Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. And then even Barack Obama got involved as a state senator and even as a U.S. senator
forcing
the banks to make these loans. They forced the banks to make these bad loans.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, Barack Obama was petitioning, effectively suing, threatening to sue banks that didn't participate. They were all taking money from these guys. And if you continue to do research on the guy who was running Freddie Mac at the time, it's amazing what the types of scandals that he's been involved in.
Franklin Raines.
Right. So the point is that all those top senators were taking money.
Yeah.
The House, Barney Frank, Maxine Waters, and a host of other people were decrying, there's nothing wrong with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. It's all very safe. What are you doing? All you're doing is you're making it a racial issue and so on and so forth.
Right.
I have all this video and audio from this. And the fact of the matter is Republicans were sounding the warning bells all along that this was going on, and they were crying everything except, you know, that it's legit.
Yeah.
And that's why we're here. But now it's time to pass the buck.
Okay.
And as recent as within the last week, Barney Frank has blamed it on Tom DeLay.
Absolutely. I have to run. So let's go. Maybe some other time you'll be on the show.
Sure.
Thank you so much for being my guest today.
All right, Mike.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Okay, now I have another guest for you. She's a financial legacy planner at the Zhang Mansion, and she's actually a member of my Toastmasters Club. And one day she invited me over to her Rotary Club's luncheon. I went to the luncheon. I was very impressed by what they did. And so I thought I'd have her on here today and tell us about the Rotary Club. So, and first of all, a little bit about herself. So, Janet Greiner, are you there?
Hi, Mike.
Hi, Janet. Good to see you.
Hi, everyone. Good morning. Hope you're waking up to exciting thoughts. Thoughts today about Rotary. I belong to the Lotto Rotary Club, but first, my business is financial planning. I work with my father, Rod Greiner, and we work at the Zhang Mansion. Our business is called American Zhang Investment Council.
Okay.
Now back to the Rotary. I joined Rotary about 15 years ago, charter member of the Lotto Rotary Club. And in Rotary, the members get to define their club by the kind of activities they do.
Mm-hmm.
Those activities are for the local community as well as communities worldwide.
And you have in one. How many countries are the Rotary Clubs?
The Rotary Clubs are in
125.
Yeah, 125 countries.
And you have how many members?
1.2 million members worldwide in 200 countries.
And you have done some kind of irrigation projects in India, is that right?
It is kind of an irrigation project,
mm-hmm.
but the word irrigation is not quite the definition. It's a watershed project. And I would be able to show anybody that's interested in a program about that, what watershed means.
Mm-hmm.
But the details of the watershed really mean that these people out in rural India now have permanent water.
Yeah.
They don't migrate for water anymore, and that only stopped 8 years ago because of wells and then this watershed project for these people.
Yeah. And you meet, once a week, once a month, and What
oh, Rotary you? Members meet once a week, depending on their club, breakfast, lunch, or dinner. My club happens to be a lunch club, and we have programs where speakers come in and talk about various subjects of interest
generally. How does someone contact you if they wanted to join or at least find out more about it, maybe attend a meeting to see if they're interested? How would they contact?
Well, I'm happy to receive calls at my office, 303-837-0872.
There's a website, too.
Yeah, and Rotary has, our individual club has a website, lodorotary.org, and the International Rotary has a website, rotary.org.
Okay, that sounds good. I think I'm going to have to run now. But, Janet, thank you so much for being my guest here today. I appreciate it, and you take care and have
great.
A good afternoon.
Great, thank you. It's good to talk to you today.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye. Well, I hope you enjoyed the program this morning. I thoroughly enjoyed visiting with you. If you'd like to contact me, you can send me an email at oemike2003@yahoo.com. And do let me know if you enjoyed listening to the program and any suggestions you might have for speakers and issues. Now, the name of this program is Exposed, so anything in particular that's new that most people don't know about, that's what I'm looking for. We come on Sunday morning, 7:30 a.m. On your dial, it is 710 a.m. KNUS. Have a good week. Thank you.